Let's not live in the past.
I only sit in seats previously sat in by tall people.
We're going to open the House Committee on Agriculture, Natural Resources, and Rural Communities. Today is February 19th, 2009. We've got three bills. Hopefully, even though I'm late, we can actually finish early. So why don't we get our folks up for House Bill 2153. I don't know who our folks are, but if someone in the audience knows who you are on that bill, come forward. Mary, why don't you tell us about the bill?
House Bill 2153 allows the Department of State lands to impose civil penalties for violations of certain provisions related to the use of state lands and declares an emergency effective upon passage. We have a minimal expenditure impact, no revenue impact, and authority to rescind the referral to Ways and Means.
Great. Thank you. Welcome.
Good morning, Representative Clem, members of the committee. I'm Steve Purchase, Assistant Director for the Land Management Division for the Department of State Lands. I did provide written testimony, but before I start, I would like to point out that on page 2, in the very first sentence, there's some missing words. Should read, Oregon Revised Statute 273.185 requires the department to file criminal trespass, but I want to point that out. At least on my copy it did. I'm here today in support of House Bill 2153, and I'm going to make my comments fairly short. I think most of you know that we manage about 2.3 million acres of common school fund lands, range lands, agricultural lands, forest lands here within Oregon. We also manage about 800,000 acres of submerged submersible lands within the territorial sea. What the department is encountering over the last several years is an increasing and growing amount of public that use our state lands for purposes that they're not authorized to do, and it's illegal activities such as dumping, timber cutting, grazing, unauthorized grazing, building and destruction of historical ranch houses and farmhouses. Illegal dumping has become one of our bigger issues that we've had to deal with in the last several years as folks are trying to avoid dump fees. Although we have authority to assess civil penalties on our state waterways, and we use that to correct some activities on our waterways, we do not have that same authority on our state uplands. So this bill will hopefully give us that ability to be able to manage our properties. Our only other option is to file trespass charges and to prosecute the same. And that's something that we're pretty cautious about before we engage in legal activity with these folks, that a civil penalty authority would give us another tool that we could use in our toolbox, that we could actually resolve these issues in a much quicker method than going to court and going through all the difficulties with that. 2153 really adds our state-owned uplands to the Department of Statutory Authority to use civil penalties for unauthorized uses, as I mentioned. Clarifies any violation of 273, 171, and 185, or any rule, order, or authorization adopted or issued by the department is subject to civil penalties. Makes it clear to the public that these unauthorized uses are illegal, and the people using these assets in such a manner may face these civil penalties. Also curtails, we hope, unauthorized activities on our state lands and provides additional tools for us to do that. As I mentioned earlier, we are seeing an increased number of these illegal activities on our state lands. We're hoping that this bill will give us some additional tools in our toolbox to be able to resolve these issues in a timely fashion. With that, I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Mr. Van Orman.
Representative, thank you, Chair Clem. Would you define for me what you mean by upland?
Chair Clem, members of the committee, uplands are upland properties. These would be upland that would not be waterways. Waterways would be, you know, land that's underneath the waters. Our uplands would be our actual common school fund trust lands that are like the land this building sits on. That would be upland.
Okay, thank you.
Dry land.
Dry land. That's correct.
Okay.
Representative Verwald.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I guess I just want to make a clarification so that we feel really clear, because as you know, there's lots of issues in my district with regard to submersible lands, and then the issue that we had to do with our rivers and streams, and the fact that for many, many years people had docks and didn't understand that they were actually using state land. And when they got their fees for rental of that property, it caused a lot of angst amongst a lot of people. And when people sell land that they, because our counties have not necessarily kept clear the record, so they don't realize that part of the property that they own, they don't own, because it's on submersible filled lands, that we aren't talking about any of that issue. That's a separate issue completely. I mean, I don't want someone who believes they own the land and has been doing stuff on it, and they haven't been charged anything from us, that we aren't going to give them a civil penalty because they're misusing the land that they thought was theirs. So I want to make sure this is clearly the different kinds of things where people are coming and that haven't been using that, or they don't have any right to be there dumping and doing other kinds of things, civil properties. And we'll deal with the other one as we deal with those other ones.
Chair Clem and Representative Roblin, that is correct. There's two answers to your question. One is that we already have civil penalty authority for the waterways.
Okay.
And the second answer would be, take a few minutes to explain how we would do this. And as I mentioned, civil penalties are a tool in our toolbox that we use to try to resolve issues, but that's kind of a last resort issue for us. We always try to work with the applicant or with the user of the property to correct either the activity, the behavior, or the unauthorized use. Unfortunately, we don't always get there. You know, there's some folks who continue to use our lands without authorization, and we will send them a proposed order. The proposed order will say, this is what we've asked you to do. This is all the contacts we've had with you. This is all the number of meetings we've had with you, and we've yet been able to reach resolution on this issue. Given that, we will give you 20 days to come back to us, work out a schedule to resolve this issue, or we will issue a final order. In that proposed order, we will tell them what the penalty will be. In our waterway program, the minimum by statute is $50 a day. And the upland statutes, hopefully that would be the same, and we can explain to them in a proposed order what we would do and what we might charge for them. Our experience has been that 90% of these cases get resolved at that point. Once we issue a proposed order, we simply do not issue a final order at that point, and the civil penalty is not applied. So it's another tool in the toolbox for us on our state-owned uplands, and we would hopefully use it as a last resort only when we cannot get them to be compliant.
Follow up?
Sure, Representative Roman.
Thank you again. And I guess the other thing I would ask, I know that DEQ and the other agencies, when they're getting into these situations, oftentimes send a note to the people, legislators that are in the district, so that they can actually know what's going on. And I know it's not here, but I would hope that as these things proceed, it isn't a surprise, because I would tell you that that's one of the bigger problems, is that by the time we understand, everybody is so angry with each other that it's difficult. And if it is possible with regard to this, and if you see any problem with this one, which would allow some notification to people, it would be appreciated.
Representative Clem, Representative Roven, you are correct. We CC state legislators on proposed orders, and we also will call,
yeah,
so you'll know what's going on, so you're not caught.
Appreciate that.
Vice Chair Krieger, then we'll go to Representative Schaffler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Roblin covered some of the things I was concerned about. And he mentioned the notes. I think Stephanie Halleck was the best. I mean, I just didn't get anything in my district that I wasn't made aware of it by the time I got it before they got their notice. And it made it a lot easier for us to, you know, keep ourselves informed and take care of our constituents and work with them. Under Section 2, I have some real concerns about the wording. If you go to line 7, it says, or any rule adopted under ORS 276. So that might mean you're going to be applying this penalty to some rule in the future. And so the legislature would be giving you authority for future rules that maybe if that particular rule, we wouldn't say that penalty is within line. And then it says, and the amount to be determined by the director of the Department of State Lands. I don't know what the criteria is that director is going to use. I don't know anywhere else in law that we allow that type of a penalty on a per-day violation at the whim of a director of an agency. And if it's written like this, Mr. Chair, I cannot support the bill.
Get an explanation of that?
Certainly, Chair Clem and Representative Krieger. This language is exactly the same language we have in our waterway statutes and the same authority that we currently use in our waterway program. When we write the administrative rules for this, we put in the rule what the penalties will be and the criteria will be. In our waterway program, we take into account a number of things. One is the ability of the person to pay, the severity of the trespass or the issue. And we go through public rulemaking when we do that. So it's well vetted as how we will assess the civil penalties. We also have a worksheet that we put together on every civil penalty that details what it is, what the resources being harmed is, what the minimum amount established by rule or by statute. And we calculate that. We sign off on that. I personally review each one of those and sign it, that civil penalty before the letters go out. I also sign all the proposed orders that go out. So it gets a pretty thorough review internally before it goes out.
I forgot to open a public hearing on this. It's implied, Mr. Chair.
Yeah. Oh, okay. Thank you. Sorry.
It's a work session.
Okay. Representative follow-up or Schaffler?
Not for now. Wait.
Yeah. Representative Schaffler?
Thank you, Mr. Purchase. Thanks for coming. And I know you got a tough job to do. And nobody wants any dumping on state lands. Nobody wants any misuse of state lands. And we're all unanimous in those comments, I believe. But, you know, in light of some of the history here, I'm reluctant. This submersible issue, you got people who have been using the waterway and the dock or their pier or their building for, I think like decades before some of these laws even came to be. Then we come and slap a rental tab on them. I got issues with that. So when you say it's the same language, now I got even more reluctant. I think our job here is to educate people on the law and how to get them to comply with the law, not to go out and slap. And I'm not suggesting you're doing that. I think you are out trying to educate people and get people in compliance. And the process you just spelled out, after that, all that process, and then the miserable bustard continues to dump illegally, then they are a criminal. They're no longer, they've left the civil part of the law and went into crime, in my humble opinion. And we have a process for that, and I have no problem busting them hard and punish them to the fullest extent. But I got to tell you, I'm not inclined to support this because I think it's just going to create more problems for people that are innocent, and I'm not interested in that. I believe every Oregonian, a reasonable Oregonian, wants to comply with the law, but if they're innocent and they've been using property for X, Y, and Z for decades before any of these laws came along, and now we're going to go out and make their life miserable, I'm not interested in that. And I know you got a hard job. God bless you. You do. You've been before committees I've been on in the past, but I am very reluctant to support this bill. And I share my friend's concerns about any potential rulemaking ability we just hand over. I really don't want to go there either. So. In fact, I would go into the submersible part and change some of that if I had my way. But I don't think we're going to do that this year. Thank you.
Representative Krieger.
Yeah, maybe a little recap of my experience. I spent 28 years, Steve, as you know, at the State Police Game Division. I was up and down every creek. In 68, 69, we got the law where it was unlawful to deposit a bottle within 200 feet of public waters. I think I made 60-some sites on that. The next year, you couldn't find anybody dumping, and the courts had some discretion what they did. I can't think of anything that anyone does on state lands as any different than on public lands, in that I was able to go out, whether it was dumping near the stream within 200 feet of water, or if it was just garbage over a bank. There's ample laws on the books now that can be enforced by your agency, or you can turn it over to a sheriff. In other words, you don't have to enforce it yourself. You can turn it over to the state police. You can turn it over to the sheriff. Some of the areas have the sheriffs that work with the Forest Service. They're paid deputy that do the forest patrol areas. They can do that for you. But I just want people to know we already have ample laws on the books to take care of, I think, these type of dumping things and activities on your land.
Want to make a response, or we've got more questions too?
Chair Clem and Representative Krieger, you are correct. We do use law enforcement to try to correct those activities, particularly the ones where we've had historical buildings or farm buildings that were torn down for firewood during hunting season. We did turn those over to the Oregon State Police. Unfortunately, by the time the officer got there, those folks were gone, and it was difficult for that officer to try to enforce that issue. But we do use DEQ's authority for illegal dumping when we can. We use as much as we possibly can, short of having to issue civil penalties. And I hopefully make this clear to the committee, civil penalty authority for us is a kind of a last resort. We don't go there right off the bat. We try to work really hard with the people to get them to be compliant. In our waterway programs, we have done extensive outreach, and we will do the same on our uplands programs. When we go through rulemaking, we're going to go through grazing rulemaking shortly. That's another opportunity for us to get the word out to the public about illegal use of our state lands. So, I certainly understand what your comments are and appreciate them.
Representative Gilliam.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you for being here. I too am reluctant because of the great tension between folks in the rural parts of my district, especially. I don't lay that tension at your doorstep. I'm just saying federal and state entities and land use issues are pretty prickly in my area. So I guess when you say 90% or so are already easily resolved through the current process, I'm interested in what round numbers, what that means. How many fall in this 10%?
Good question.
Representative Chair Clemon, Representative Gilman. Our experience has been that, and in the 90% that's solved, are solved after we issue a proposed order. As I mentioned, we work very hard to work with the applicant to try to resolve those issues right up front. If we can't get there, then we issue a proposed order. Once they get a proposed order and they realize that what the state's pretty serious, they're going to fine us if we don't do this, that generally brings them into compliance. And we don't have to go to a final order, and therefore we never issue a final order, and we don't collect the civil penalty. It is simply another tool in the toolbox to help us get there.
I understand that.
Yeah, a follow-up.
All I'm trying to get at is just a round number of how many cases you've got, and so what would 10% of that number be statewide?
Chair Clement, Representative Gilman, right now, currently, we have 7 cases that are trespass cases. 4 of those have been resolved through some fairly heavy lifting on our side to get those resolved. 3 are unresolved.
One last comment. I would say that doesn't push me towards this bill. I don't doubt that those are important cases, and I don't think I can support the bill. But I would say this as a representative, and I know the folks up here on this panel would offer to you anything we can do in the middle of these cases to advocate for resolution. We want to do that. But the bill is not my cup of tea.
Before we go on, if I might just ask a question so I can understand, can you tell me what these 3 cases involve? I mean, what are people doing? Because in the abstract, it's really hard to know, but I mean, are they burning down things? What are they doing?
The 3 pending cases, Chair Clem, the members of the committee, the 3 pending cases right now, one of those is a someone who is using our state lands to farm wheat, grow wheat on it. We've asked them to get in compliance and get a lease from us, and they have not been willing to do that. Another one is a communication site lease there where someone's using our upland for a communication tower, has refused to enter into a lease. And the third one's an illegal dump, and where someone has entered our property, dumped their trash, left it for us to clean up, and we've not been able to get them to clean that up right now.
Do you think the wheat grower believes they have some other sort of historical natural right to the property or some other document?
Chair Clem, this is not our understanding. It was a situation where it's a small piece of state lands inside their holdings. They just simply farmed it and kind of assumed that we would not come and ever ask for anything. And we finally found out that they were farming our land, so we asked them to get under lease.
Yeah, we're going to be having more conversations today about those kinds of situations. One last question for me, I think. Once you do the proposed order they see you're serious, they come into compliance, do you just withdraw at that point the whole thing, or is there a settlement agreement, or do you just withdraw the order?
Chair Clem, we have a couple ways we've dealt with that in the past. One is we do not issue a proposed order, or a final order, excuse me. In our proposed order letter and the proposed order itself, it says that if we don't reach an agreement within 20 days or come up with a plan to resolve this issue, the order will become final. We actually send out another final order. If we reach a settlement, if depending on who's involved, it could be a settlement agreement that's constructed. It could be that we work up a plan for you to come to us, make your application. Once you make your application to use our state lands, we accept that. We withdraw that proposed order.
Okay. Representative Roblin, then we'll come back over here.
Thanks again, Steve. And I agree. You are working very hard, and this is your job is to protect that land. It is owned by the citizens, and proceeds go to the school fund. I appreciate all those things. The concern I have, you know how long it took to get a map for the Coosa Bay area of what the state said they owned and what we all worried you thought you owned and all those conversations. So, I mean, this goes back to 1859, figuring out where lines were. Do we know all the land that is ours, or are we still working on that? And so people will find out as time goes on that they are on land that they thought was theirs that isn't.
Chair Clem, Representative Roblin, we do know where our uplands are. fortunately for us, when we became a state and the federal government gave us our land grant, we do know where those lands are.
And have those maps been pretty clearly shown out there with people so that they know?
Chair Clem and Representative Roblin, we believe that is the case. Okay. I can tell you in all honesty, however, that not all the county assessors have kept up with who owns what land. And it's not unusual in some of the rural counties to have a parcel of land simply be noted as the state of Oregon. It doesn't say which agency owns it. It doesn't say, who might be responsible. It has also been our experience over the last 20-some years that I've been in our department that occasionally someone will sell land, and they will put in the deed, and they will transfer a piece of state land, particularly if it's an in-holding within their property, without even understanding that's what they've done. So to that extent, we have worked really hard with those county assessors to get that corrected. So we are pretty confident that we do know where our state uplands are and that the public also does know. We're very close to having our state lands mapping project online so the public can actually go onto our website and find out where our parcels are right now.
Just to follow up on that one. As you mentioned, there are a number of situations. This is 1859 stuff, and we've had transfer of titles. Land has been filled. It has been sold, and sometimes we lose those kinds of things. It is the policy of the department currently that when ownership changes and they believe there is an issue, to start at that point and work out the problems with the new owner who didn't know that he had that problem in the first place. This creates some real angst amongst us, and as you know, we've had this conversation. So I wish we could figure out a way to get out front of this and let people know these historical lands, because I clearly understand, as I've been working on the last 6 years on this issue, that it's that the state owns the land. I mean, I understand that. It's just that we have, and I know that there's no statute of limitations with regard to that with respect to the state, as opposed to other people. If, if I had a piece of property and then my neighbor had a piece of property and we put a fence up together and it turns out that the fence was in the wrong place, after a number of years, that becomes whosever property it is. Not true with the state. So the fact that we haven't let it be known for sometimes 50 or 60 years, depending on the ownership time, is a real issue that I think we have to get out more in front than we have. So if this bill made sure that happened, I'd would be more inclined to support it, because I'd know they were actually going to know before a deal was made and they bought the property, and then they have to pay for it twice. That is very frustrating to me. So just a statement.
Representative Krieger.
Steve, you mentioned the farmer that had the wheat and you can't get him to. How many acres is it that the state lands owns that's surrounded by his property?
Vice Chair Krieger, I believe it's 10 acres.
Do you want to follow up?
Sure.
has he ever showed an interest in wanting to purchase it, or have you ever decided you wanted to sell it because you've been encouraged to sell some of those lands that, you know, they're not blocked up together? Has that ever been discussed?
Representative Krieger, we have not discussed that with this individual, nor has he asked to do that. Our asset management plan adopted by the board in October 2006 does identify about 24,000 acres of in-holding lands that we are willing to dispose of. 11 of those parcels are going up for sale in March, but unfortunately this is not one of those.
Follow up?
Yes.
How many of those landowners, other than those 11 that are adjacent to your lands that are in holdings, have been notified that that is a possibility?
Representative Krieger, we have put out public notices. We have sent notices to all the adjacent landowners. We have sent notices to the county. We've talked with the county commissioners. Every time we go out in the public, we mention that we are doing this. It's on our website. We're going to put out another round of public notices just before we do the auction at the end of March. So we're trying to get the word out that these parcels are indeed up for sale. As I mentioned, there are some 24,000 acres, about 12,000 acres of rangelands and 12,000 acres of forest lands, mostly that are in holdings within, you know, larger ranches, larger farms, or sometimes within national forests as well. So we're trying to get that word out to people what is available for sale. And also to add to that, if that individual wanted to sell or wanted to buy this property, he can make an application. We then have to go through our process to determine whether or not the land would be available for sale and how and what mechanism we would use to sell that and what value that would have. As Representative Roblin has been through this issue with us a couple times, it's a fairly lengthy process for us to go through to dispose of a piece of property.
Yeah.
Okay, Representative Schaffler.
Yeah, the longer we're here, the more questions I'm going to have. So you have to go through an appraisal process, I'd imagine. And you have the state has an appraisal, and then I'd imagine the potential purchaser may want to have their appraisal. And if they differ, can you sit down and say, we're going to split the baby here? Can you do that, or are you bound by law to go with our state appraiser's appraisal?
Representative Schaffner, we do require an appraisal. The appraisal is one of the tools that we use to set the minimum price when we sell a piece of property. If it is a direct sale to the applicant, hopefully we've already worked that out with them up front of what we would hope to get back in return for the property. We are not bound by that appraisal, but we are bound by the amount that we set we think is the minimum amount. We have a number of sale methods that we have in our state rules on land sales that we can use. Direct sale, auction, could be a public bid auction, could be an oral auction, or it could be a negotiated price. So when we go to our state land board and we ask for permission to sell that piece of property, we identify the sales method up front. And if we have a sense that it's going to be negotiated, we'll simply ask for that negotiated authority up front.
Madam Chair, may I have one more?
Yes.
Very briefly. And is that true for purchasing, that you're not bound by that appraisal, that you can negotiate a price if you're purchasing as well?
Representative Schaffler, if we were to acquire a piece of property, we actually have a little a rule about acquiring property. When we go out and acquire property, we try to acquire that at the appraised value, just the same as a private landowner.
Give me a minute. If I may.
One more.
Is that in the statute, or is that just an unwritten policy? Which is it?
Representative Schaffler, that is in our land sale rules.
Okay, thank you very much.
Representative Gilliam.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I move that we strike the language of this bill and direct the Department of State Lands to increase timber and wheat production by 75%.
You do that to me every time. I'm hearing no second.
Yeah, that's good. I was going to move the table until August, but it's okay.
All withdrawn.
Steve, on an in-holding like that, where you have to go through some of the property, what kind of an access right does the state have to have a road to that property through that adjoining property?
Representative Krieger, kind of a tough question, but I'm going to try to answer that. There's always a prescriptive right for someone to go to their property, and you know we have not enforced that or tried to bully our way into access. When we sell a piece of property, we notify the public that access is an issue, that there might not be legal access.
Okay, follow up.
Yes.
I think we need to understand on those types of lands. ODOT has some lands where, you know, adjacent to a highway, and the adjacent landowner wants to lease it. That land has a whole lot less value than a separate piece with a public access, because, like with ODOT, there's only one person that has a way to utilize it, because there's no way to put a building on it. It doesn't meet any type of code where they could use it for anything. So they only have the one buyer that has any way of purchasing it or leasing it. So those leases aren't going to be as valuable as a similar-sized lot adjacent that could be incorporated in. And I would have a suspicion. Do you know if, when you talk about these types of small, especially the small pieces, I'm not talking 40, 100, or 1,000 of acres, but these small little pieces, it seemed to me like the value would be very minimal. It's not big enough for another person to farm 10 acres of wheat, and then you have the access issue. Do they take that in consideration of the price when they put that up, do you know, in some way?
Representative Krieger, when we have it appraised, that is one of the issues that the appraiser will look at, is the highest and best use of the property, and that's usually based on the current zoning, if it's EFU, if it's agriculture, if it's forest, whatever it is. Well, they will always look at the access issue, and when they look at the value of the property. They will look at other factors that we might give them instructions to look at. It could be, is the land contaminated? Does it have other difficulties with the property that would make it difficult to sell? All that goes into assessing the fair market value of that property.
Good, thank you.
So let me just do a check. We're not going to be voting on this bill today. If you have questions that help you get to wanting to vote on this bill today, let's ask those. If not, let's move on, and we can have some discussions about whether taking the OAR out, you know, here and the other place are going to help or not. But let's just be merciful to Steve, and we'll take the rest of this offline.
I do have one question.
Oh, Representative Van Orman, this
yes,
is going to get you to a yes.
Well,
no.
Actually, you know, it's interesting that there are a number of things that have come up that I think divert from some of the intention of the bill. But one of the questions I have, which I'm very concerned about, is the dumping. So are there no other avenues for you to pursue to deal with the dumping, the illegal dumping on state lands?
Representative Van Orman, the only other issue that we have would be to file criminal charges, and under 273-185, where the director is required to file trespass charges and prosecute the same, is what the statute says. And that would be our other avenue.
Okay.
And then the other thing we try to do is work with DEQ. If they have some kind of enforcement authority, or the county, try to work with the local county officers about, does the county have any authority that can help us here to get this cleaned up?
And they don't.
And so if you caught somebody who was illegally dumping and you end up having to pay for it, do you have a way of recovering those costs? She says euphemistically.
Representative Van Orban, that would be true. We would have to go to court to recover those costs.
Okay, thanks.
Great. I'm going to close the public hearing. Thank you, Steve.
Thank you.
Open a public hearing on something else. House Bill 2082. Why don't we get our folks up, and Mary, tell us about the bill.
Okay. House Bill 2082 revises provisions governing formation, consolidation, and dissolution of soil and water conservation districts and inclusion or withdrawal of land within soil and water conservation districts. It eliminates provisions regarding imposition of land use regulations within districts and provisions regarding payment of county extension agent employed by the district. We have a minimal expenditure impact statement, no revenue impact statement, and there's no referral. This bill has been through Dash 1 and Dash 2 amendments, and they have been engrossed now, so essentially...
No, that's not possible.
Well, not engrossed.
We have to vote? No. Don't we have to vote on amendments? Would they?
Let me finish
talking. Sorry.
Representative Chair. What I was trying to say, probably not correctly, is that the amendment you have before you as Dash 2 is the bill now. Everything's been merged. Is that not possible?
I don't believe that's... No, I'm getting not...
No?
Yeah, it's not. We have to vote on them We have to vote on amendments,
yes, have to vote
or
on
else they can't happen. Yes. So that's why they're not merged.
Okay.
I think. So getting a lot of nods.
Are they?
We're both new.
Mr. Chair, are they a replacement of?
Okay, so, well, hold on. Sorry.
You go first.
Representative Beyer, who never gets to ask or say anything.
All right.
Hi.
are the amendments a replacement of the bill that we have to adopt?
That's a good question.
I'm sure they are adjustments to certain lines, not a replacement of the whole bill.
Okay.
Yes. Representative Roblin.
My question is, were the amendments submitted to LFO and others, so when we have the minimal impacts, are they with respect to the amendments?
Yes, we have the minimal, and the impact statements are on the dash one and the dash two as
okay,
well.
Okay, that's important.
Yeah, we have all of them.
Okay. Excellent. Hi.
Did we open the meeting?
I did open the meeting, okay. I think. Yeah. Hi.
Hi. For the record, my name is Gary Whitney. I'm the Executive Director of the Oregon Association of Conservation Districts, Salem, Oregon, Chair Clam, members of the committee. Thanks for the opportunity to speak with you this morning in support of this bill and or amendments. Just to kind of clarify what I know about what we have in front of us, it's labeled proposed amendments. However, the dash one amendments were actually about 5 or 6 pages, and the dash two amendments were about a single page. So I think what we have here is the bill language with the dash one amendments and the dash two amendments all in here. I don't pretend to know how they
we
why they did it that
accept
way,
them,
but
I think.
Okay.
I think we still have to accept
engrossed in the bill.
The engrossed bill.
But the I'm sorry. Let me just get to where this. So when I'm looking at House Bill 2082 as it was printed,
that's
original.
I think it was this bill.
Yeah, that obviously doesn't have any amendments in there. That would be impossible.
Right.
Okay.
And then we did the dash one amendments, which were never heard in front of the committee.
Got it.
And those were 4 pages long. And then we submitted dash two amendments, which was about a one pager.
And so the 2082 dash ones, you then incorporated into dash two?
Yes, and then they were all wrapped into the bill.
Okay.
So we're back to.
Got it. So the dash twos are an exact copy of 2082 with the amendments you want made.
Yeah, I think that's correct.
Okay. Okay.
Everything's in here. That's what I know.
And that the problem is in here when people have been saying that they were holding this up or referring to this.
Right.
This is the House bill, and that's not possible, I don't think. So the proposed dash twos include everything that was in 2082 originally and the changes you want made.
Yes.
Yes.
Correct.
I just apologize, yeah. Committee. I'm just not grasping it until now. So we shouldn't even look at 2082. We should be looking at 2082-2. That's got everything we need to look at in it.
Exactly.
Yes.
Correct. Yes.
We just got that. You know.
If there's no further questions.
Yeah. I didn't have time to read all of it.
Well, walk us through. Walk us through, because none of us have seen this yet.
Excellent. Excellent. And if it pleases the committee, there's a representative from ODA here, Larry Oyua, who has many years of experience with district and ODA relations, relationships, and how that all works. And he's been instrumental in helping getting this language together.
Okay.
And he could come up and
we need him.
We'll save your time. Okay. I submitted to you the written testimony, but also a one-page summary of that I thought I'd walk through real quickly with you, and then if there's questions, we can go from there.
Okay.
This is an update to the district's authorizing statutes, which is a series 568-210 to 568-808. Some of these statutes are old and have been in on the books for a long time, and we need to take a look at doing this legislation for a variety of reasons, one of which is to take out of the district authority some things that districts aren't doing and frankly don't want to be doing, such as land use regulations and the ability to hold contested hearing cases on land use regulations. Mm-hmm. And districts are all about voluntary conservation, not land use regulatory authority. So we're deleting those things off the books. We also want to clarify the authority for districts to meet today's challenges. The renewable energy focus, help landowners develop renewable energy resources on their property, even some services projects. We also have districts, metro districts now, right in the heart of Portland area, that are providing services equally to our historical base, which has been rural working agriculture, and as well as urban landowners now as well. So helping them with invasive species, which isn't just a rural issue. So, you know, we want to make sure that we're updating to modern challenges. And we also want to streamline the statutes to allow minimizing of election expenses where possible, and while still giving the public an opportunity to be heard. If there's any conflict in the local area, make sure people have a chance to be heard. But if there's really if it's not a contested action, then allow us to do it without having to hold a public election. We're also doing some other important refinements to modernize the relationship between soil and water conservation districts and the Department of Agriculture. Soil and water conservation districts are fortunate because we have a great working relationship with a state agency. ODA has a staff that work a lot with soil and water conservation districts, and we want to update that relationship a little bit because, as I said, districts have been around for a long time, as has ODA. But as they've evolved, I think the workload for ODA to try to do what's in the statute now would require a lot more people than ODA has or could likely access in today's budget climate. So we want to streamline that relationship and be strategic about it and make sure that we're getting ODA's important help on critical areas. We're maintaining ODA's authority to oversee district elections, formations, dissolutions, and consolidations. But on the other hand, there's language in the current bill and the current statutes that say ODA is going to provide written approval on every project. And that's just too much of a workload for ODA. And districts have grown up, if I can use that phrase, and are, flying on their own in some respects. So we wanted that to be a partnership, a technical assistance type thing, without burdening ODA with trying to be there on every project with written approval that, could potentially put the state at some liability. And finally, in the last 20 years or so, some districts have been successful in getting local property tax levies passed by voters to do local conservation. And that creates a little bit of a wrinkle and when you start talking about consolidation and mergers, because what if one has a tax levy and the other doesn't, or they want to consolidate a certain zone and there's different tax levies. So we had to go back to the Department of Revenue and get some advice about, how does that actually work with special districts. To the extent possible, we've incorporated the existing language that governs special districts into our statutes. We're not trying to reinvent the wheel. We are trying to give districts the access to the current statutes and the current regulations if they have to go there. With that, if there's any questions, I'd be happy to.
Representative Shoffler.
Mr. Chair, I got a dozen questions, and for the sake of time, I'm going to invite Mr. Witte up to my office later to go over this. There's a lot in this bill, Mr. Chair. I read it this morning, and a lot of things leap out at me. First of all, I support soil water conservation districts. They do great work. I support your ability to establish them, to people's ability to withdraw from them, to close them down if necessary, the public hearing process for the landowners and the taxpayers. They do great work. But there's a lot in here, and we just beat the tar out of a bill that I don't think is going anywhere, and I can get to yes on this bill and what you're trying to do. I need to learn a lot more about this, and I don't need to take up a half hour of this committee's time to do it, Mr. Chair, unless you want me to.
Well, I was thinking about that. One option might be if you would be willing to sort of summarize the questions and answers and email them to the rest of us. Because we might learn something from the questions if we did take the time now, but, it also might be, we got floor in a while, and it might be more expedient just to kind of get us a little play-by-play minus the profanities, et cetera. And,
I never, get, Mr. Schultz.
Oh, I meant our friend here. does that seem reasonable?
Certainly, yeah. Okay. We can do that.
Anybody else have something at the moment, or you want to wait and see what our good friend to the right can come up with for us?
The
There's a lot going on.
Yeah, Representative Gilliam.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For those of us new on the committee, I don't want to belabor this, but in just a few seconds, just give us the thumbnail of your association and its relationship either to the districts or to the state.
Thanks for Chair Clem, Representative Gilliam. Thanks for asking that wonderful question. The Oregon Association of Conservation Districts is a statewide association for Oregon's 45 soil and water conservation districts. We have one employee. We're situated here in Salem, and we provide technical assistance, help districts orient with training, and coordinate with the what we call the Conservation Partnership, which is ODA, Natural Resource Services, and Farm Service Agency. You know, the usual things that state associations do.
Quick follow-up, Mr. Chair.
Yes,
please. For instance, I see one of my favorite constituents here, who, and she's associated with the Association of Oregon Cities. What? Who do you report to, and where does your budget come from?
I report to, Chair Clem, Representative Young. I report to the president of the association, John McDonald, and we have an executive board, and our budget comes from primarily grants. We do have district dues, very high participation rate of districts around the state that pay their dues to us to support our work here and, updating their statutes. We don't have a professional lobbyist, but yes, I report to the president, John McDonald.
Great, thank you. Representative Krieger.
Mr. Chair, haven't had time to digest this thing, really. Going through it real quick, and I see lots of big new bold print. Maybe, for instance, you had one entering into agreements, Section 26. I would have thought you were already doing those types of things. And the goal, with watershed districts, with the it just doesn't. I think we're going to have to spend some time on it. And then I saw tax levying authority. And then all of a sudden, to place liens on real property, to enter into written agreements, to coordinate activity, goes on and on. So much of this, I thought, was already in place. So why do you need it now if you didn't have it before? How does it make you work better, be able to serve the districts, the people in the districts? But I just think, like Representative Schaffer said, we need to take a look at it and have this before us a little bit more, because this is probably an hour and a half's reading, and then trying to reference back to certain statutes that are referenced in here, you got to go look it up to see what you're referenced to, and I haven't had time to do that.
Yes,
Chair Clam, Representative Krieger, you raised some good points, and Larry Oyo is the state expert on these issues, but I can address a couple of the comments. Sometimes, when you move language to a different spot, then it becomes bolded text, even though it may have been in the statutes before. So I'm sure districts were doing written agreements. The background on the ability to place liens, I think, is something that's come about as districts have gotten their own taxing authority and have entered into their own grant programs. My understanding is that some have received advice from their council to make it explicit that if they're giving a landowner a grant for a conservation measure and the landowner then doesn't perform or maintain that structure, say it's nutrient management, they want to shelter manure, then they need to be able to come back in there with a lien and say, okay, you're not doing what the grant said you were supposed to do. You're not keeping up. You're near the bargain. And so that they can get the public benefit out of the project that way.
Okay. So we will close. Well, actually, let me just ask. Anybody in the audience who feels like they could inform where we know the plan from here. Does anybody have anything to add on any of those things that they want to come up and talk about? I don't see anything on the sign-up sheet, but...
But I have a request, Mr. Yes. Chair. I would like to talk to the department about this, too, in the future.
Great.
They could actually come together. That would be nice.
Yeah, maybe you could schedule it jointly. Okay, I'm going to close this public hearing. Thank you. Okay. Over two. Let's try it. Come on. House Bill 2458. Three strikes and you're done? Or, I don't know.
It's always the simple ones that we think are simple. Always. So that, you know.
Good practice for a new chair.
But you do have a, Mr. Chair, a committee that...
I love my committee. I actually really like my committee a lot.
But
all
I'm
of
not,
you.
Yeah, well, some sure are more right. challenging than others. Yeah. Well, I apologize for that.
Boy. Welcome, gentlemen. Mary, do you want to tell us a little bit about House Bill... Oh, let me open a public hearing. House Bill 2458. Mary, why don't you tell us a little bit about it?
House Bill 2458 allows Commodity Commission to establish per diem payment to members that exceeds payment amount otherwise allowed. No expenditure impact, no revenue impact, and we have a rescind referral letter signed by the Speaker on this bill.
Great. And this is Mike Juan and Nels?
Yes.
All right. This is our entire list. We've got every element for success right where we need it. Let's do this.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mike Dewey on behalf of the Oregon Potato Commission. With me is the Chair of the Potato Commission, Mr. Lon Bailey, and also a member of the Potato Commission, Nels Iverson. I've instructed as counsel for Mr. Bailey that there will not be any answers to any questions on the Klamath Dam. So I'm just going to move on.
Please.
This is much more, I think, much more straightforward than the two other bills that you had. What we want to do first is give you a brief overview of commodity commissions, in particular the Oregon Potato Commission, and Mr. Bailey will do that, and then Mr. Iverson will talk about what the bill does, and again, the referral to Ways and Means has been rescinded in that the legislature does not look at the budgets of the various commodity commissions, ag commissions. So with that, we'll go with Mr. Bailey.
Good morning. You guys are almost colder than Klamath.
I might need you to state your name for the record.
My name is Lon Bailey. I live down in Merrill, Oregon. My business is in Malin, Oregon, partner in Bailey Troutman Farms. Fourth generation potato farmer down there in the basin on the California and Oregon side. We raise upwards of 1,400 acres of potatoes a year. Frito-Lay is our largest customer for chip potatoes. Raise grain and hay for rotation reasons. So I am chairman of the Oregon Potato Commission. The commission was established in 1949 by state statute. We promote Oregon potatoes. Our big job is to educate consumers, retailers. We conduct research. We work with government agencies regarding potato policy and local policies also. We're funded entirely by the potato industry through assessments on a 100-weight basis, and I believe 100% participation for all Oregon potato growers. We receive no general fund dollars. All of the commissioners, which are five districts with alternates, chair, and outgoing, so seven officially voting committee members, are appointed by the Director of Agriculture, and every meeting that Oregon Potato Commission has is ruled by the open policy meeting or our public meetings. So with that, I'll turn it over to him.
And before we do that, Mr. Chair, just to the bill, and Mr. Iverson will speak to that. So the bill basically allows commodity commissions, ag commodity commissions, which are described in 576-265, to set a per diem for their members that are on the commission. So that's what the bill does. The per diem in statute is not more than $30. And we think it's appropriate for a commission to be able to, if they choose, and commissions may choose not to adopt a per diem, they may choose to adopt a per diem of $10, $20, $15, whatever. But this allows the individual commissions to set a per diem above the $30, which is in statute. And historically, the Potato Commission had a per diem above $30, but they were informed by the Attorney General's Office and the Department of Ag that they We're not following the appropriate state law. So that's why the bill is here, and we'll discuss the reasons that we think it's appropriate.
Yes, Mr. Chairman. My name is Nils Iverson. I'm a farmer here in the Willamette Valley. I live in Jefferson, and we farm from Jefferson to Canby. We grow a diversity of crops, including potatoes. We're probably most known for the tulips, which we raise up in the Woodburn area, the main farm is. I'm involved in business with a brother and a sister, which allows us to participate in industry programs. If it wasn't for three of us there, we could not participate, whether it's in Farm Bureau or Commodity Commissions, because we're a small operation. I have spent almost 18 years on the Potato Commission. I spent 10 years when I was much younger and then was off for about 9 years and have come back on again. I've not only served on the Potato Commission, I've been on the Oregon Processed Vegetable Commission. The commission provides a lot of support for the growers. If it didn't, I wouldn't be there. I believe that we do things legislatively. Currently, we do quite a bit of things with the National Potato Council, which looks at labor issues, transportation issues, trade issues. And a lot of those issues may not directly affect me, but eventually they do. So that's why we participate in that. I spend an average of 2 to 3 days a month doing commission business. And I spend about 3 to 4 hours a week keeping up with the emails and staying current on current issues. I'm currently on a committee, on a stakeholders committee, that's in the process of selecting a new dean of agriculture for Oregon State University. Mm-hmm. So we become involved with various activities. We're involved with Oregon Ag in the Classroom and other issues. With my location here in the Willamette Valley, it makes me close proximity to many of the meetings. Potatoes are growing over a wide distance in the state of Oregon, from Ontario to Klamath to Hermiston to Central Oregon and here in the Valley. And for somebody on the far east side, it's quite a time investment to come. We rotate our meetings around the state, so we all have opportunity to travel. Some of the members of the commission are small growers. They're a one-man operation, and like in our operation, if you're not there, the work isn't getting done. I'm kind of grateful for cell phones so that you can kind of manage at a distance and take care of issues at a distance, but still it's an inconvenience to serve, and it is not a, let's say, generally a money-making proposition. You appreciate the contacts you develop in the business, and you appreciate what you learn in that, and hopefully you can move not only your operation forward, but the industry forward. It is, let me say, to be prepared for meetings and so forth, a lot of time is spent that I do not receive per diem for. I do receive mileage when I attend meetings, but if I'm only going for an hour or two, I just don't file a per diem if it's just for a very short. But if I'm going to go out of state or spend an all day at a meeting, I do that. But sometimes there's costs that you don't, I mean, you can itemize everything and turn it in, and sometimes that's more of a nuisance than the money that is involved. There are some commissioners that don't come to meetings at times because of issues at home, and I've been in that situation also. But it's certainly, it is grower dollars. We do have a public hearing for our budget. It is very transparent. We follow all the appropriate rules, and the per diem is a line item, and it's something that is reviewed, and we certainly want to be respectful. I have served on other committees for some cooperatives, and their per diem is about 10 times what we are right now, and it's we're not going to go that high. Thank you.
Thank you. Let me ask a couple questions. We've got a bunch of members. Maybe I'll get to some of them too. Commission members are elected, appointed? How do you get on it?
The commission are appointed by the State Director of Agriculture, Katie Koba, or whoever is the current Director of Agriculture, from a geographic growing area, which
and
we have five.
Do we know if she's got a process to take input from industry and growers who pay the fees and who are members of the that particular commodity on who ought to be the next appointee?
She sometimes looks to local growers group because we all have a growers association, and generally two or three names are recommended, and then it's up to her discretion to appoint the appropriate individual.
Mr. Chair, usually there's a grower organization like the wheat growers, and there's a wheat commission, the livestock cattlemen's, and the beef council. So usually they reach out to find out who's interested. But at the end of the day, it's the appointment. It's not a good old boys club here. It's an appointment by the department.
Okay, so that's what I've. Well, I'm actually the other one. Are you related to Ken?
He's my younger brother.
I'll be darned.
I've done a bunch of legislative work with him, and I know if anybody raised it too high, he'd be all over you about it, so I'm not now real worried at all. Representative Krieger, then we'll just go right down the row over here.
That one.
Okay, then over here.
Maybe not so much about the bill, but farming is people and families. Did you know Clyde Dillinger years ago? Dan Mathis?
Very well.
I want to tell you a story about... Got it.
Okay.
Because I call it my prior life when I was at the State Police Game Division over there. And there was a light out in the field about 2 o'clock in the morning between Malin and along the hill road there. And, of course, I parked my rig, go charging out there. I think I had a guy at the deer, and I ended up helping Clyde pull a calf at 2 o'clock in the morning. So you just don't know who you're going to run into. And now, we can't talk about the Klamath Dam, but there are people in this room... I was one of them. You know, I put $500 into the farmers on my own dollars when they were having a tough time over there. And we are going to support farmers and ranchers in that rural way of life. I think it's important that they know when they you come this far that you've got friends in this building. We want to support the farmers. And that issue that you brought up, Mr. Dewey, is one that'll boil over time.
I know that, so that's why I advised him.
It is surprising how you interact with people and find out who you know. And I went to OTI clear back in 59 to 61 at the old campus, you know. So there's a lot of people over at Klamath, and we support what you're trying to do. And these commodity commissions, you know, they kind of take care of their own. They oversee their own entities, and we need to give them what the tools they need to do it.
Representative Schaffler.
Yeah, thank you. I just ibid on what my friend was saying, and first of all, I just love taters right out of the gate. And I support this bill completely, and we need to, I think this committee, obviously very supportive of agriculture and farmers and the American way of life in this room right here. And you do have friends in this building, and we need to get more water for ag up the Columbia and a long list of things to help you continue to be successful, because I want my food coming from America, not somewhere else. But I just wanted to make sure when I read this, I thought, well, I doubt those potato farmers or flower farmers are going to be hanging out in some spa with some international financier spending American stimulus dollars, so... I very much support your bill and just to reimburse you for what we won't be able to reimburse you completely for your costs, but at least try to defray those costs. So keep up the good work.
Thank Representative, you know what it's like to be in North Dakota in February?
Yes,
for
I do, sir.
I'm going to go to Representative Van Orman and then come back over.
Thank you. First, I would like to expose my pedigree. I am the great-great-granddaughter of Mary Mulrooney Hamilton, who escaped the potato famine in Sligo, Ireland. So potato is an important product in our family. And then I was a pelican. So, and in case those of you who don't know what a pelican is, that is the mascot of the Klamath Union High School. Klamath Union High School. So I spent 2 years there. It was quite different than Wisconsin, I'll tell you that. But anyway, what I did want to say is... having been a Head Start director for 22 years, running a poverty program with poverty wages, We did have a per diem rate, but eventually we went to the federal per diem rate because every community is different. It costs you more to go to Washington, D.C. than it costs you to go to Salem, Oregon. And so I am fully supportive of a per diem rate that supports people to do what they're supposed to be doing, because I think it's one of the values of organizations is the ability of people to see other people, meet other people, and to promote what we're trying to do in Oregon. So I like the other guys, support this bill.
Okay. I am going to ask one of my vice chairs, and I need to step out for a moment to field the rest of the comments and questions, if that's a second. Representative Rowland, I'll call on you. Just one quick, could you address while I'm gone, didn't sometimes pirates have to, like, eat pelicans just to get through?
I'm shocked that the pelicans got lost going over to Kwan. The navigation must have been off a little
huge
bit.
Huge nesting area. Okay. As big as it used to be.
I guess I have a couple of questions. This is actually an issue that's coming up throughout the building, just so you know. It's not just the commissions. And I appreciate the fact that the commissions pay all their own. It's their money from them. It's not general fund money. That's an important aspect in this bill, because we're having conversations with respect to other groups and that $30 requirement. I thought there was also a requirement on the mileage that's not close to the federal reimbursement rate. Is your mileage also low, or do they pay you the 55 cents a mile?
It's the same on the mileage.
It is the federal rate. Okay, that makes me feel bad. That's why it wasn't addressed.
Yeah.
So the question that I have on this one, and I guess it's just a cautionary thing, it always gets hooked up with respect to income tax issues. If you pay a per diem that's higher than the federal allowed rate, and then you have income coming in as opposed. So when we give you an unlimited deal, I guess my issue is to make sure that you either pick that other one or do the exact reimbursement, because I think that's the other one that when you go to those places where the conference is, you have to go there, and your hotel rate's more than your per diem, you should be able to get reimbursed, and it sounds like you can do that. So from that perspective, I guess I just want to... Clearly, this is a good thing. You guys are paying for it yourselves, and there's no one I would trust more with my money than the farmers. They know what they have to do, and that next year might not be as good as this year. So, I mean, I think they're careful. So I appreciate the commission's doing this. I think the Crab Commission does amazing work for the Dungeness crab industry. So if we can support it, I feel very good about this.
Mr. and Mrs. Chair, the Department of Agriculture for each commodity commission pays based on their revenues into a person at the Department of Ag that advises on commodity commission law, rules and regulations, and so forth. And I suspect that not only would the administrator who's here, Bill Brewer, but the Department of Ag would counsel the commissions on these technical issues like the income tax. And I hope they will.
Who's presiding?
Yes, Representative Gilliam.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I know this will affect all commissions, but just for the record, tell us how big potato production is in Oregon right now. What's going on with potatoes?
You can't eat this one.
Go ahead. I'll back you out.
We're down to about 100 growers. And the production is about 35,000 acres. It kind of varies up and down. Nationally, at one time, we were number three in the nation, and currently we're number five, number six, somewhere in that area. What we like to look at is 60% of the potatoes are grown in the three states, Idaho, Washington, and Oregon. Oregon is about 8% of that. Oregon it has been very instrumental in opening markets. The Oregon Potato Commission was involved with opening French fry markets in Korea, Japan, fresh potatoes in Korea. Currently, we're about 60% of the fresh potatoes in Taiwan that are imported in. So Oregon is very important to the developing overseas market, because we don't have a large enough population base to consume all we produce here. So we're very dependent upon exports.
Representative Roblin.
Follow up on that same question, because I think it's important. How many not the fresh ones, but how many processors do we have in Oregon now?
We have, for potato chips, there is only one here in Salem, that is Kettle. There is a dehydrator in Boardman. There is one plant in Hermiston, Lamb. Okay. And then there's a plant over in Ontario. And then there's a small one down there in your area. Or are they over in California?
They're not going anymore.
They're not going anymore. But in the Hermiston area and in Ontario, they're close enough to the border that things move back and forth.
I know.
Follow up. Yes.
So in your area, transportation, big issue? Getting your product?
Fuel's down a little bit, so it's not nearly as big. From Klamath coming to Portland to compete with Hermiston area or Washington, yeah, it's a huge issue. But going to California, we're relatively competitive.
Okay.
You know, our issues, even though I was mandated not to speak of them, yeah, since 2001 have been, you know, we were down to one-third of the potato acres on the Oregon side in the years, you know, directly following that water crisis, and we're about halfway back up to that acreage now. We were up, you know, 15 to 18,000 acres, and we're barely 5,000 in 2002. So we're trying to, you know, get that back up. And like Nell said, a lot of our, you know, logistically for export reasons, Oregon is a key state. And we would much rather sell our potatoes domestically, but with the whole U.S. Potato production, or if you just take west of the Rocky production, we can't consume everything. And it's not that we can't consume everything, but consumer preferences have been declining for potatoes to other carbohydrates and other you know, prepared foods. So
thanks.
He still has his First Amendment.
Sorry. Hello. Do we have further questions?
Mr. Chair.
Yes, Representative Byer.
And I had most of my questions answered yesterday in the discussion, and I do support the bill. And I don't want to, you know, out my naivete on, you know, agriculture, but what is included in the potato commission? I mean, what kind? Is it just the standard potatoes, the, you know, Yukon Gold, those kind of things, or do you include, say, sweet potatoes or?
We only raise white potatoes. We are putting an assessment is on those are for processing for French fries and potato chips. Those are for the fresh market, the russet, which would include Yukon Golds and Reds and specialties. Those for the seed industry. And if there's an organic grower, that is, we assess on that also. As far as activities of the commission, a bulk of our money is spent on research, variety development, diseases, so forth. We also have activities in market development overseas. That's foreign market development, which is a small portion. We do legislative type issues on the national level and a little bit statewide. We're involved with consumer research. We have a research project at the Oregon Food in Portland,
Innovation Center,
on trying to identify characteristics in potato that we can identify quantitatively so that we can help in variety developments there. And then we have we put some of the funds back to a local growing area where they support extension and aphid trapping and other activities of the local growers.
Yeah, I might add, and this is perhaps an aside, but Oregon State University is very important to the research component And because of the funding issues, they're impacted like everybody else, and there are a couple of potato scientists that are retiring. So we have issues about how do we fill those particular slots or a slot. And those are issues that ag has in general anyway, but it's something that's very important to us.
If I may, we also provide representation on the National Potato Council and the U.S. Potato Board. So the state of Oregon, or Oregon Potato Commission, based on the number of acres, we have three representatives on each one of those organizations, and that's what, those are the ones that take a lot of time to get to and from.
Thank you.
Okay. Oh, I have one question that I'm going to have to know first, the next thing here. Do we know if the pear bureau or I'm not actually sure with the cherry. What happens if you grow pears and cherries? Does this bill cover you or not?
Did you declare your conflict?
I'm about to. I've got to find out.
Well basically, each commodity commission could be impacted by this bill. Could be the status quo. They could, if they're not paying a per diem today, they could choose not to. This is permissive. So the Potato Commission would have a meeting and look at their budget and decide whether or not they wanted to raise it.
Do you know about, so I'm sorry, I really just wanted to know if I have to declare a conflict. Do you know about the cherries, if they're covered under the statute or
not? They're covered in this bill.
Okay.
All Oregon commodity commissions are covered. Okay. We didn't want to just say the Potato Commission. We wanted to make it very clear that commodity commissions.
Totally appropriate. Thank you. So I, Representative Roblin.
You know, you may choose to do this because it doesn't hurt, but... think about the conversation we had about who's the class, and it would cover anybody who, all of the people who in that commission are covered, and all of the other people. So when it comes to conflicts of interest and things like this, this is a fairly large class if you're talking about it. I think you can do it to cover yourself anyway, but I'm just saying you aren't on the commission currently. You may become on the commission.
Well, that actually was the only angle, not as a payer.
Right.
If I ever were to be on it, I think it's a pretty small class then.
Yeah, no, because it's open to anybody that is in the industry.
Yeah, but the receiver of the per diem is a very small number of people.
But you can still declare it if you want. It never hurts to do it.
If it was tight for time, I wouldn't, but I'm just going to declare my potential conflict of interest for the record. We co-own a portion of an orchard that pays these fees, and I may at some point get roped into 18 years of service on one of these commissions at least.
That's an anomaly.
Anything else on this? No, I'm a supporter, obviously. It's your money, and I think there's an appropriate public process, and if you get out of line, you'll hear about it from your neighbors and your little brother, and they'll go to Katie Cova and say, get him off of there. All right. I'm ready to open a work session. Close the public hearing on House Bill 2458.
Thank you for your time.
You bet. Thank you. And open a work session on the House Bill 2458.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Krieger.
I move House Bill 2458 to the floor with a due pass recommendation and a subsequent referral to the Committee on Ways and Means be rescinded.
Representative Krieger moves House Bill 2458 to the floor with a due pass recommendation and that the subsequent referral to the Committee on Ways and Means be rescinded. Do you also want to move it on the consent calendar, or do we do that after this?
You can take the vote and
then date now. Representative Roblin?
Just a comment.
Yeah.
My comment is that, and I expect that they will do well in our hard economic times.
Oh, 1 second, sorry. Still just need to get the motion right. Did it have the consent calendar in the motion?
No.
You
did
that part.
I do that.
At
no, afterwards.
You can take the vote.
This is your script.
Okay.
Keep on going.
Just decide it's on the consent calendar. I have to have you all.
Representative Byer has some advice.
Yes, thank you, Representative Byer.
I mean, technically, you have to have a unanimous vote to put it on the consent calendar, so you would probably want to do the vote and then move
thank
to
you.
Put
that's
it on
the consent. That's what I thought. Yeah.
That's right.
Okay.
Yeah.
So
maybe we should just step out of the room again.
Sorry.
Yeah, if I would just leave, things would go smoother.
Just a comment on the motion that's on the floor.
Let me just restate the motion.
Okay.
I'm sorry for Ezra.
No problem.
So Representative Krieger moves 2458 to the floor with a due pass recommendation and a subsequent referral to the Committee on Ways and Means be rescinded. Is there any discussion? Representative Roblin.
Thank you. I just wanted to say that we are in amazingly difficult economic times, and I trust that these commissions will make appropriate decisions because it can come back to haunt them in these times when they change the amount up when everybody else is doing worse. And I just, it's just a difficult one for all of us to have to deal with. I think we have, that $30 is ridiculous with respect to what they have to pay to go there. And I think they have to make those adjustments. But these are difficult times, and I just remind people.
You tied to legislative per diem.
I ain't
$100 bucks, right?
That.
Or something, $99?
Now, let's not go that far. Right,
sure.
Oh, he wakes up then.
Any further...
I heard somebody trying to cut into my per diem.
any further discussion? Okay.
I agree.
Is there any objection to placing this bill on the consent calendar?
Well, first, why don't we just vote?
Oh, you vote for...
We have to vote for...
I'm sorry. Would the clerk call the... Yeah, me too. Would the clerk call the roll on the motion that was on the table?
Representative Byers.
Aye.
Representative Wingard.
I love the consent.
Aye.
Vice Chair Van Orman.
Absolutely, yes.
Vice Chair Krieger.
Aye.
Representative Shaw.
Aye.
Representative Gealy.
Aye.
Representative Robles.
I'm somewhat conflicted because of our chair. Are we voting on the motion? Or the...
Aye.
Can I rule him out of order in the middle of a thing? Yeah.
Have him objected, Mr.
Okay,
Chairman.
Okay, now you can ask if there's any
objections. I have to vote, so I think.
Right. Oh, that's right.
Aye. The relatively competent chair declares this motion passed. Is there any objection to placing this on the consent calendar? Seeing none, that's so moved. Oh no, so moved, Representative Sharp. Thank you. That motion passes. Okay, thank you, committee members. We got one bill passed today, and I appreciate your patience with me. I'll keep trying to do better. Thank you very much, and I'm going to adjourn the committee.
I passed three votes out in my committee in a half an hour. Okay. Well, if we didn't have such...